This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. In two recent regional elections, German voters expressed their discontent by voting for fringe parties in record numbers. What is happening in Germany with Chancellor Angela Merkel's popularity in decline? And with more and more Germans feeling unrepresented by their politicians, there's a real crisis developing that should be of concern to all of us. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brad McDonald about what's next for Germany. As the United States becomes more aggressively secularist, there are more and more examples of people not being permitted to practice freedom of religion. Today, we're going to talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the case of military chaplains who are being punished for quoting the Bible. Fatigue, brain fog, achy muscles, feeling out of it. Millions of people suffer from these symptoms because of issues with their thyroid gland. If you're one of them, you'll be glad to know that there may be quite a lot you can do to solve this problem. We're going to talk with nutritionist Jörg Mardian about the causes for thyroid dysfunction and how to begin restoring your thyroid to good health. And I'll conclude the program today by talking about how to squash sibling rivalry. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Germany has enjoyed remarkable political stability for decades. It's had only three chancellors in the last 34 years and only nine chancellors since World War II. But there are signs that Angela Merkel, the current chancellor, is in trouble politically. The political climate in Germany is very tense right now because of a number of problems besieging Europe. It seems only a matter of time before Chancellor Merkel is gone. And what will happen next? Who will lead Germany next? Trumpet writer Brad McDonald is taking up this question in an article he's writing for the next print edition of the Trumpet News Magazine. We have him here via Skype from Britain. Hello, Brad.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Good to have you on here. We don't get to have you very often, but always appreciate it when we do. So Germany's had a couple of elections recently that give us a pretty startling picture of the state of German politics today. Why don't you start by just giving us an update of the latest?
Sure. Well, it looks like we really could be moving into what will be a historic moment in German politics. 2 weeks ago, there was a regional election in Germany's, in Angela Merkel's hometown or home state. In that election, the CSU, Angela Merkel's political party, came in third. It had its worst showing in history in that election. The AfD, the far-right party in Germany, actually came in front of the CSU. So that was really a significant development. And then just this past Sunday, there was another regional election in Berlin. So this is the seat of German politics. This is where the federal government is. It's really at the nucleus of German politics, obviously. And in this election, the CSU had a terrible, terrible showing. It came in third again, I believe, with only, I forget the number, I believe it was 15% of the vote. Now, what's interesting here is that the AfD, this is the far-right party, they won 14% of the vote. But in addition to that, the left-wing, the far-left party, they also won 15% of the vote. So the far-right and the far-left won 30%
of the vote. That's pretty
remarkable. In this regional election, in the heart of German politics.
And maybe you could just give us a sense of how historically unusual it would be for these fringe parties to have that kind of showing rather than the center parties.
Right. Well, the CSU and the CDU have dominated regional and national elections since World War II. The AfD in the last regional election was in the single digits, 1 or 2% of the vote. They just got 14. I don't have the figures for the left-wing party, but it's the same. They were in single digits just a few years ago. Now they're winning, you know, by double digits, or they're having double digit victories, they would say. But what's interesting is the fact that between these two marginal political parties, they won 30% of the vote. And then the Greens, which is considered somewhat of a marginal political party in Germany, they won 14% of the vote. So 45% of the vote in Berlin went to three marginal political parties. Now, what does this mean for the CS? Usually, regional and federal politics have been dominated by the Christian Socialist Union. In Bavaria, it's the Christian Democrat Union and the SPD, the Social Democrats. In this election in Berlin, 40% or 45% of people voted for a marginal party. Mm-hmm. What a reflection on the state of mainstream German politics. The German people, well, at least the people in this region of Berlin, they're losing their faith. There's a major faith crisis in the mainstream political parties in Germany.
That's amazing. So I do want to just get into some of the crises that are causing this exodus of German voters away from those mainstream parties. But you you talk in this article you're working on about just how we can get some good ideas of what we can expect to see in Germany in the time ahead by looking back at history. And you specifically point to the Weimar Republic. Maybe you could just give us an overview of why that would be significant history to look at.
Sure. The Weimar regime was the government that ruled Germany from the end of World War I until its end in 1933. It was essentially replaced by Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists. This party was never popular. It faced, I forget the number, but there were quite a few attacks, as in people tried to kill Weimar leaders. There were 14 different national elections during the 14-year period that the Weimar regime ruled. It was weak. It didn't incite confidence. Obviously, in the late 1920s, there was a major global financial crisis. The Weimar Republic didn't handle that well. What happened is the instability became so systemic and so bad that in elections in 1933, a significant number of the German people voted for an individual who promised to rescue them from the conditions created by the Weimar regime, mm-hmm. Who promised to restore German territory in these different lands, who promised to stop paying reparations to the West, and that of course was Adolf Hitler. But he came along and he exploited the national disgust and disenfranchisement that existed for the Weimar regime.
So obviously, you talk about 14 governments in a 14-year period and the instability that really characterized that interwar period. Obviously, the government that was established after World War II was specifically intended to stabilize that country and to resolve a lot of that instability. And just looking at the political stability that Germany has enjoyed since then, it definitely did the job. A lot of people looking at the situation today would say this is nothing like the Weimar Republic. You know, Germany has experienced they're not anywhere near the kind of instability that they were during that period. However, the point you make is the crises that you see besieging Germany today are starting to mirror some of those same conditions that we saw before that led up to Hitler's rise.
Absolutely. I'm not saying Germany today is led by a Weimar Republic regime type of government. However, just because Germany's had a lot of success, its government has had a lot of success since World War II in just creating stability and structure and order. I mean, there's nothing to say that that's going to continue. There's nothing to say that history couldn't repeat itself. Just a couple of quotes here. George Friedman today wrote an article on the elections that just happened in Berlin. He wrote, "In Berlin, at least, the German political system has shattered." And then he said, "If the Berlin results are replicated on a national level, Germany is going to become ungovernable." Just one final quote. He concluded with this: "In my view, there is a growing sense in Germany that the German system is failing." So it was... When I wrote my article a couple of weeks ago, I was a little bit concerned that I was being overly dramatic or maybe taking it a little bit too far. So it was reassuring to read George Friedman today and just listen to this very well-respected analyst make the same observation. The system is failing.
So that's that disenfranchisement, that disillusionment among the German voters that we saw in the period leading up to and precipitating Adolf Hitler's rise. In some way, you see that same kind of thing happening today. Let's just talk about some of the crises that make that history relevant again.
Right. Well, first and most obviously is the inflow in the past 12 to 18 months of more than a million mainly Muslim migrants. That has a lot of German people just deeply alarmed. Who's going to pay for this? They're alarmed by the cultural impact it's going to have. They're alarmed by the tangible, documented rise in violence. They're alarmed by the fact that Germany is already experiencing Islamist terrorist attacks, some of which are being performed by migrants that came in over the past couple of years.
This is probably the main issue that really separates the German people who are voting for these fringe parties from their chancellor, isn't it?
It's that. And there's also a bit of a growing resentment for the EU as well, which we're seeing all across Europe. But the Germans increasingly are concerned about the economic outlook for their nation. There was a report that came out this week that said growth in the third quarter is going to drop. There's concern that Germany isn't going to be able to maintain its exports, that the United States, because its economy is suffering, you know, they expect exports to the United States to drop over the next 12 months or so. And this in particular is where the German people, they think back to that pre-war period when there was high unemployment, high inflation, a lot of economic uncertainty. This is, you know, when you start talking about economics and unemployment going up and fewer jobs and wages falling as German companies try to save money, this will really impact the everyday German. And this is what will drive them to some of these more far-right parties and look for a leader who's going to promise or who's going to provide solutions for turning around these problems.
Yeah, that's a good question, because as much dissatisfaction as there is among German voters, who really do they have to who's stepping up and making those kinds of promises?
Right. And that's the point I make in this article. Germany is not alone in the massive amount of public dissatisfaction at the government. But in America, in Britain, in France, in all of these other countries, you have individuals, be it Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or Nigel Farage or Marine Le Pen, I think it is in France. You have people who are standing up and saying, I'll represent you. I'll defend your interests. I agree with you. Here's my solutions for solving these problems. The analogy I make in the article is that all of these countries have a Superman, or they have someone who at least wants to be Superman and say, I'm going to fix these problems. Mm-hmm. In Germany, there is no Superman. No one is standing up saying, I will replace Angela Merkel. I hear your concerns. They're legitimate. And here's how I propose to fix them. So there's just no one is doing that.
So these fringe parties, AfD in particular, maybe they're capitalizing on some of the specific concern that the Germans have over, say, the immigration issue. But it's not necessarily a personality-driven movement.
It's not a personality-driven movement. And it's also not a multi-subject, for want of a better term, movement. You know, the AfD is making its gains almost solely based on the fact that they want to stem the flow of migrants into Germany.
Right.
That I'm aware of, they don't have a detailed plan to fix Germany's economic problems. Mm-hmm. They don't have a detailed plan to fix Germany's relationship with the EU. They're a one topic party.
Well, that's an interesting point. So there really is, if you add sort of the confluence of all of these factors together that are pressing on the German people, there really is an opening here for somebody to take advantage of that and say, well, look, I want to fix the economy. I want to fix immigration. I want to fix some of these wider issues with Germany's relationship with the European Union.
Right. That's exactly right. I suspect that most of the people voting for the AfD don't support the individual. They don't want the individual to become chancellor. They don't have a whole lot of confidence in him to run Germany, or her, I think it is, because they know that she's just so single-faceted. She's just – she only knows how to do one thing. They want a regular politician. They want a politician who's, you know, balanced, who's been exposed to how to work in Berlin, who has experience on the international level. But there is no one. And what this means is, if you're a German, if you have aspirations for leadership, if you're hearing what the German people are saying, this is just a fantastic opportunity to come along and just say, let me be your Superman. Now, who that is, well, that's where that's an interesting question.
Well, it's definitely something. It's a question that's been on our minds at the Trumpet for many years because of the biblical prophecies that specifically talk about a strong man standing up in Germany. And as we're watching this void, this leadership void develop in Germany and seeing the opportunity that would really be there for someone to step up, it does point to and it highlights the fact that the editor-in-chief of the Trumpet has been talking about this for years. And specifically, he's focused on a few different individuals over the years, but the one that we've been really looking at, what has it been, maybe 10 years?
At least.
Is Carl Theodor zu Gutenberg.
Right. And the more this situation comes into focus and the more we kind of watch KT zu Gutenberg, as they call him, the more I marvel at the fact that this is something we've talked about for 10 years. We have to wait and see what happens, but it really does look like the situation is, or circumstances are being set up for this man, even this man in particular, to come to Germany's rescue. He was once the most popular politician in Germany. He's been Germany's economics minister, I believe. He was once the defense minister of Germany. So he's not a marginal politician. He's absolutely not an extreme politician. You know, he's viewed as mainstream and normal. He's just the kind of guy that I think the German people would very willingly throw their support behind.
And he's not going away. I mean, it is remarkable when you look at how long he's been at least prominent enough that we've had our eye on him. And here, going through those different portfolios, his crisis that drove him from politics and kind of sent him into exile for a while, he's still always been in the picture. And all of these times where you have journalists who are approaching him and saying, well, what would you think? Do you think you'd ever want to get back into politics? Just his coy answers, like he's never shutting the door on it. He's always just talking, well, I don't think so. But it certainly does make you wonder. It's very interesting to keep our eyes on, and we appreciate you keeping us up to date with that. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Brad McDonald about Germany's political crisis and where this could lead in the coming months. It could happen really at any time that we could see a pretty significant change over there. He's working on an article about this subject for the coming Trumpet print edition. You can watch for that online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks again, Brad. That was great.
My pleasure.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Religious freedom was one of the pillar freedoms on which the United States of America was founded. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. But in recent decades, there's been an aggressive effort not just to prevent the establishment of a state religion, but to prevent any religious expression in any public context in ways that actually violate the protection against prohibiting the free exercise thereof. One remarkable example of this is taking place in the U.S. Armed Forces. Chaplains and even soldiers are being expected to uphold policies and rules that violate their religious beliefs. To discuss this, I have Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Great to be in the studio.
So let's start by talking about the most recent controversy that demonstrates the government abridging freedom of religion within the military.
Right. I think the biggest controversy that they've had within the freedom of religion with the military is their policies regarding the chaplains' corps. That's the corps of religious preachers who are assigned to minister to the spiritual or moral needs of the soldiers. And since they've repealed the don't ask, don't tell policy in allowing homosexuals to openly serve in the military.
And this was a policy that Bill Clinton established as a means of just kind of avoiding the issue of homosexuality within the military. And then this was repealed just, a couple of years ago?
Right. Well, for like the first, two centuries or so of American military history, it just wasn't legal for a homosexual to serve in the military. Sometime around, I think, 1992, 1993, Bill Clinton had made what they became colloquially known as the don't ask, don't tell policy. That saying said, well, if you tell us we're homosexual, we kick you out. But if you keep it to yourself, we're not going to ask you about it. Mm-hmm. And then with President Obama, just in 2014, they've repealed that saying, said, no, you can tell us you're homosexual and openly serve. And they've even gone on, I know the Marine Corps has even gone on like recruitment drives to even like set up recruitment booths at homosexual centers, like civil centers, to actively recruit into the military.
Okay, so now the policy is it's okay to be a homosexual and to serve in the military, but what we see now is going beyond just it's okay. What they're telling the chaplains is you better embrace this or else.
Right, because when it had first Admiral Mike Mullins had mentioned to one of the chaplains who had expressed maybe some concerns about how their counseling sessions would go or if they could quote the Bible and things like that. And he pretty much just came down and said, if you can't get behind the new program, resign your commission. And so most of the chaplains have been, have gotten in line with the new program and have not been like actively chasing homosexuals down the base and berating them for their sins. But several of them still do in private counseling sessions if someone comes to them and asks, like, okay, as my chaplain or as my minister, what does the Bible say about homosexuality? And they'll get in there and quote this. And now, even more recently, they're even trying to outlaw that. Probably the most high-profile case was in 2014 when a chaplain, and as a naval chaplain, Wes Motor, he was assigned a new assistant. And I guess his assistant was in a homosexual relationship and he didn't know it. So they started asking him a lot of questions about, well, what do you view about homosexuality? And he'd quoted the Bible to him just saying, this is my beliefs. And so unbeknownst to him, the assistant actually went back through like his counseling ledger, found the people he'd counseled for the past several months, went and talked to them and found out there was one. And these are all people, all these people in this counseling ledger are people who came to him for advice of their own volition. Mm-hmm. He's not, like I said, he's not trying to unsolicited information. These are people who came to him for counseling, and he found that he'd told one young woman who wasn't married and had premarital sex that was shameful activities in God's eyes due to this scripture, or one young man who was struggling with his acceptance of homosexuality and said, well, said that's wrong biblically due to this scripture. So he'd gotten this found this testimony from some of these people. And I guess some of these people, even though they had come to him of their own volition, were offended by the advice they ended up getting. And so reported him to the base commander and had him suspended from his duties. Not completely kicked out of the military. He was just suspended from duties, kind of in like a hiatus status for 2 years. He'd gotten with the First Liberty Institute to fight that legally. And after about 2 years, they did reinstate him to his position. The policy didn't change. They still let him know that he wasn't allowed to counsel based on the Bible. But they said he could come back to his old duties, which because of his age, I think part of the big reason they made that decision is they knew he was retiring within the next 12 months anyway. So that was definitely a public statement to all other chaplains that this is what happens if you're quoting the Bible in your counseling sessions. Fortunately, because of the lawyers at the First Liberty Institute, Chaplain Motor has still been able to retire with full benefits and get his pension. Otherwise, he'd have been like an old man who lost his pension because he quoted the Bible.
Yeah.
So he is keeping his pension, but he's also retired now, and they've made a very strong statement to other chaplains that this is not acceptable behavior. I think shortly after that, there was a chaplain that, and he didn't get fired, but he was giving a mandatory session on depression and suicide prevention. And he quoted the Book of Psalms as King David as an example of a warrior who'd been struggling with some of the same post-traumatic stress issues and how his reliance on God got him through that. And so he definitely got, a written warning from the base commander to don't quote the Book of Psalms in any future anti-depression.
So this isn't just regarding homosexuality. This is the Bible is off limits.
And I think the difference there is I think the homosexuality, they're still allowing you to quote the Bible in private counseling sessions, as long as you're not quoting Bible verses that say homosexuality is wrong. Only those verses are off limits. Hmm. Because the second case was a mandatory anti-suicide prevention, there may have been a few atheists in the group that they said, well, you can't quote the Bible. But again, it's not him quoting just these really dogmatic Christian doctrinal statements. He's quoting inspirational poetry from King David, who we've got archaeological proof. He's not a mythical biblical feature. He is a historical figure. I mean, he could have quoted history from some Persian emperor and it would have been fine.
Right.
But if he's using the Bible as a historical, it's like, okay, well, this king was a warrior who had dealing with the same issues you're dealing with, and this is what he said got him through it. His faith got him through it.
Well, that's remarkable. So on one hand, if you're just looking at it from the standpoint of a chaplain who's being asked a specific question and he's supposed to answer based on his own understanding of his religious tradition and scriptural underpinning, that he would want to answer what he believes to be the truth. However, the question would arise, you're talking about, say, the chaplain corps. They are paid for by the government, and could someone argue that, well, look, we're talking about something akin to the establishment of a religion since this is paid for out of the public trust, and if he's quoting these Bible verses, that's tantamount to, crossing that line between church and state.
That has been argued several times. Now, the Chaplains Corps was established by General George Washington in the American Revolution. It was obviously important to him that God was on his side during his fight with the British, so he was trying to cut down on people swearing or sexual abuse or anything like that in the ministry, so he wanted chaplains. And they'd always, even James Madison and all the founding fathers, had always argued that this was constitutional because the First Amendment guarantees two religious rights. He said, one, you have the freedom to freely practice your religion, and two, the state won't make a state-established religion. The military is a special circumstance because if you send a soldier to Afghanistan to fight on behalf of the U.S. government, he can't just go down to the local Methodist church on Sunday if he mm-hmm. wants to. Mm-hmm. They said if they were going to protect their right to freely practice their religion, we have to provide them with military chaplains that can minister to those needs. So they make the case that you have to have the chaplains corps to give soldiers the ability to freely practice their religion. Now, in order to not have a state-established religion, even in General Washington's time, there's a letter he wrote to Benedict Arnold really emphasizing the need that make sure you have chaplains of different denominations. If you have soldiers from Anglican soldiers and Methodist soldiers and Presbyterian soldiers, those are common denominations in the revolutionary time, make sure you have chaplains of all three of those religions. Mm-hmm. And we have Hindu and Sikh and Jewish chaplains in the military today. So it said that's how you have no establishment of religion, is you have chaplains of several different denominations. But if someone comes to them for private counseling, the freedom of religion part is they need to have the freedom to teach their religion. That's why you hired a chaplain of that religion. Mm-hmm. If you hire I think he was a Baptist, but if you hire a Baptist chaplain and then tell him he can't quote the Bible, you're violating his freedom of religion and the freedom of religion of the soldier who came to him for counseling. Even though some of those soldiers may not have liked the advice they got from him, they still did come to a Baptist chaplain for a reason, to see what does the Baptist religion teach on homosexuality.
Right, and it's trumping the religious teaching with the policy of the secularist policy of the military. And I'm guessing that there haven't been any Muslim soldiers who have complained about Muslim chaplains preaching against homosexuality, or that hasn't cracked down on any of them for any of their beliefs.
They tend to gloss over that, but it is definitely true that if you wanted, it would be perfectly constitutional if you wanted and I think they even are trying to get atheist chaplains in there now, kind of a strange concept, but I guess it would be legal.
I'm an atheist chaplain. Yeah, that would be an unusual job description.
But by telling the Christian chaplains that they can't teach their religion, they're actually making the atheist chaplains, the state established religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fascinating stuff. And I this is a subject that I think we really do need to dig into more, because we're talking about a very narrow policy within a very small segment of society. But this is really something that you see very broadly happening within American society, and a whole lot of examples of the abridgment of that free exercise clause of the First Amendment, where it is establishing a state religion, anti-religion religion. And it's something that really all Americans should be very concerned about. We have a completely different understanding of what the First Amendment is about today than it was at the time that the Bill of Rights was established. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's written an article called Silencing Christian Chaplains. You can watch for that online at thetrumpet.com. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour.
Do you feel tired all the time, or do you have a foggy mind? Do aching muscles and stress make it feel like your life is draining away? Suddenly, I feel like I'm a commercial here, but if you do have those problems, you're not alone. You could be suffering from thyroid issues, and research shows that this is a problem that is experienced by somewhere around 27 million Americans. Different estimates say that somewhere between 10 and 40% of people have poor thyroid function, and 60% of those who do don't know what the cause is, or they're unaware of it. To talk about this, I have holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian via Skype from his office in British Columbia. Hello, Jorg.
Hello there.
So tell us about the thyroid gland and why it's important.
Well, the thyroid gland is really called the master gland of the body. It's just a small butterfly-shaped gland at the base of the throat. But what it does is phenomenal. I mean, it produces two main hormones, T3 and T4, and they're responsible for the body's metabolism and energy. And I mean, without this working properly, you really have a hormonal soup, and you know they're misfiring. So it's kind of like having one foot on the brake and one on the gas of a car, and you just don't know which one to push. And it sends a lot of confusing signals to the body. And in your introduction, when you were talking about people being unaware of this, when we look at this problem, it's a big problem, because it really, the signals that gives really sounds like a lot of other problems. So you can misdiagnose that very, very easily and say, unless somebody's looking for that specifically, and you say, look, could it be a thyroid problem? And you have those specific tests for it, you might even miss that. So,
right. So let's talk about some of the signs that you could have thyroid problems then, symptoms that you'd be experiencing.
Right. So there's if you have a hyperthyroidism, that means it's just being overactive, and then it can lead to heart problems, bone problems, anything where you just have way too much energy, and you have joint stiffness, joint fatigue. You could get just anything where you just don't feel good, and it seems like your foot is on the gas. Everything's going fast. Whereas conversely with hypothyroidism, there's enough fatigue that you get, and you might be sensitive to cold or weight gain or muscle ache. Again, you can have that, and joint stiffness. So some of the symptoms do overlap, and as well as depression, but that fatigue is big. And the biggest one that's out there is the hypothyroidism, where it's just not producing enough hormone, and those symptoms really overlap with a lot of other conditions of the bodies, which is why I say it could be misdiagnosed.
So what are some of the causes? Why would the thyroid not function the way that it should?
Well, in my trade, in the natural Jade, we look at the cause and effect, the real cause, what the body's doing, why it's misfiring like that. You know, so we look at, there's four main causes that we would look at. One would be toxicity. So you could have radiation and heavy metal exposure, which is prevalent today. And that's not really looked at that much. Nutritional deficiencies are pretty big. So you could, iodine is a big deficiency today that you could have, even though they say that isn't prevalent because we're taking iodized salt. With the scare that we have now with salt and the health dangers, people are cutting back on that. So, and then selenium is another big one that should be in a diet. Food intolerances, they're another one. When we look at gut conditions and, you know, leaky gut and, food intolerances, there's a big one today. We talked about this previously with the genetically modified materials on a previous program, and as well as hormonal imbalances. And that is, say, from dietary, if you're taking in too many carbohydrates or too little healthy fats, so your cortisol levels just keep climbing and climbing, and then your hormonal levels just become all distorted. So those are the four main ones: toxicity, deficiency in certain nutrients, food intolerances, and then the fourth one, which would be hormonal imbalances.
So the food intolerances, you're saying that the intolerance for certain foods is actually a cause for thyroid dysfunction?
Yes. Well, look at gluten. Gluten is a humongous issue today. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many people suffer. It's actually shocking how many people suffer from gluten intolerance. And they're actually looking at that now as one of the causes of thyroid imbalance, because the body, if you have an intolerance to that, gluten is actually one of the causes for leaky gut. And so the body really just attacks itself. It's an autoimmune condition. And anything with getting rid of autoimmune conditions, really, we were talking about healing the gut. And when we talk about healing the gut, we're again looking at food intake and, lifestyle factors and things like toxicity from metals. I mean, we're really exposed to a lot. The body's just being bombarded today. So pinning this down is not easy. It can come from 20 different sources, or it could be one main source.
So it seems like that fourth cause that you mentioned, hormones, that tends to be related in a lot of cases when someone is having a thyroid issues, that it's kind of hard to pinpoint exactly what the cause is, which is leading to which. You're talking about hormone imbalances causing thyroid issues, but it does seem like there's almost a cycle there where they play in one into the other, and it's kind of a difficult thing to pin down precisely what the how to resolve that.
Well, when we look at, in my profession, when we look at resolving body issues, we have to go right to the very source all the time and say, the body works best when it's in balance. To come back into balance, we have to do those things that bring it into balance. We can't just say we have an issue and therefore we're going to treat that issue. The big problem is that we eat so many bad foods today, especially carbohydrates, and then we have sugars and grains which kill gut bacteria, and then we have so many unhealthy fats, and especially women. It really affects them when they had taken that many carbohydrates and their hormones. So we really have to look at healthy fats. I mean, I'm still shocked at how few people know about healthy fats like coconut oil or coconut milk, avocados, say healthy meats, healthy fish, you know, wild fish, mm-hmm. say chia seeds or flax seeds. We really need a lot of those in a diet to feed the gut. And less sugar, less processed food, which really destroys the gut bacteria and causes those conditions. And it really is it's a storm that it causes in the gut, you know. And then leaky gut, the body just attacks itself, really. We're causing an autoimmune disorder here, and then we start getting all this. It's like a shotgun blast, and it goes out in all directions. And we're saying, where is all this coming from? But when we look at people here at my studio, when I look at people and I say, let's start at the beginning, and when we do attack the gut and get it healthy, you'd be surprised how many people in a short period of time get rid of a lot of these symptoms.
So you really are talking about, you're addressing the very root cause, the underlying cause of so many of these problems that tend to manifest itself with hormone imbalances, and then that impacts the thyroid. If you just go back and you say, well, let's just build your gut health, that tends to get the ball rolling in the right direction in these other areas.
Absolutely. About 80% of our immune system is located in the gut. I mean, it's that important. And an unbalanced gut flora has been linked to almost every disease. And that's not even a question. That's been proven, including thyroid imbalances. So given its complexity, you know, it's no wonder that the immune system is sort of uncharted territory for many medical professionals, because they really don't deal with that. They don't deal with whole foods and issues where we go back to the beginning of this, genetically modified foods, processed foods, gluten, antibiotics, toxic chemicals. What we're doing is we're bringing our system under a systemic daily attack. And then the immune system itself, then attacks the body. Mm-hmm. So we're creating the conditions that gets the body to turn on itself, organ by organ and system by system. And then so we have, when we go to the medical professionals, they're looking at it and saying, wow, look at this organ and this organ and this organ is affected. Whereas in the natural health, we go back and we say, well, why is it being affected? Mm-hmm. What is causing it? And then so when we look at the gut bacteria, usually you can see those symptoms. Look, I have constipation. I have diarrhea. I'm burping up all the time. Acid reflux. Well, that those give us a real good indication that you're not eating good and you're not feeling good. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are things we can do for the gut. Absolutely.
Well, I definitely would like to talk about that before we finish. But when the thyroid begins to succumb to some of these causes, what is actually happening there with an unhealthy thyroid?
Are you talking about the symptoms?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, okay. How does that affect us? Once the thyroid begins to not function the way that it should, then... I mean, you talked about it in general terms, putting on the brake and the gas at the same time, but how does that really affect us?
Right. So with hyperthyroidism, again, you're going to feel, you have a general condition of feeling nervous and moody. You're going to be weak and tired. The heart's going to just be beating fast. You might have problems breathing. You could get hot and you could get sweaty and you could lose weight. So those are conditions when it's overproducing. And say if you do have hyperthyroidism, you could even lose weight even though you're eating the same amount of food or more than usual. So you're just burning too much. So the other way around, which is far more prevalent, is hypothyroidism, of course. And the general fatigue is just a big one there. It's just you feel off and nothing seems to go work right for you. There are other conditions, of course, because you feel very sensitive to cold. Constipation is another one, a big one in that. Dry skin. Your muscles are affected because you have weakness and aches, and you're going to gain weight on that as well. Joint stiffness or depression. So those are symptoms that you have to look at as a whole and say, what could be causing it? And it can be hard to pin down because, like I said, they can they can be the same as other symptoms of other diseases of the body. So we have to be specific when we look at that.
So what sort of tests do you take when you're trying to get to the cause and determine, is it the thyroid that's causing some of these problems, or do the prescriptions that you recommend, are they general enough that they would benefit anybody even if it isn't a thyroid issue, or not create problems if it were some other cause? How do you go about specifically starting to correct that? You said that you tend to go after the gut and trying to improve the health of the gut. Is that something that would benefit anybody anyway?
Yes, of course it would. I mean, even if you're healthy, it's always good to use prevention. What we talk about is the medicine we really need. If you go to, in general, synthetic thyroid medicine is given for much of this. And I'm not a believer in just stepping in and getting medicine immediately. What we want to look at is probiotic foods for the gut first. So we want, and some supplements, so we can get the gut bacteria back into balance. So we want to do kefir and fermented milk, sour pickles, sauerkraut, sourdough bread.
Fermented
Those are
foods.
All wonderful foods. Miso and tempeh, which is a fermented soy, not the commercial type. You want the fermented. And then you can also, when I talk about supplements, you can take probiotic supplements. And I'll tell you, fermented foods and supplements do wonders mm-hmm. for the gut. When you look at synthetic medicines, what you're really doing is you're not attacking the cause with that. So to get rid of thyroid disease or any autoimmune condition, you have to get the source of the imbalance, not just suppressing the symptoms. So if you take medicines, I mean, you're on that all your life. Mm-hmm. You know, so we want to really do all that we can to get rid of this. And who's to say we can't? I mean, 95% of people who have this, they're just not going in a natural direction and they're not being led in that way. So how do we know that isn't working? We see it in my profession. We see improvements. You know, we want to boost the immune system. We don't want to sabotage the immune system and then keep wrecking the thyroid gland and then say, now we need support for it. So there are certain things, you know, that we can do. We want to BPA in bottles. We have to be careful with that in plastics. Mm. You know, we don't want to get into that. Heavy metal detox. There's herbs that we can take for that. So milk thistle and turmeric, chlorella. Those are wonderful ones to detoxify the organs of the body and harmful metals. We can get more selenium, and that's really needed in the, by the body for thyroid function. And those can come from Brazil nuts and salmon, sunflower seeds, beef, mushrooms, and I think onions. So and then as well, and this is an important point, lower your carbohydrate intake. We eat so many carbohydrates today that we don't understand. A lot of my clients, they're at 60, 70% carbohydrates daily. Mm-hmm. It's all refined and sugared and chemicalized. And then, you know, we're creating that perfect storm again in the body that creates these imbalances.
So how much, you're talking about quite a few factors that are involved here, several different causes for thyroid dysfunction, some of which are affecting the hormonal balance within your body. And so you're playing with chemistry here. How much of this can someone kind of self-diagnose? Or are there other resources that you think it would be important for someone to go to get some input on this type of thing? Where would somebody who's listening to this and say, yeah, I could really use some of this, do you think would be a good place for them to start?
Well, I mean, it's always good to get tested. If you believe that you have a thyroid condition, you can get tested and say, look, do I really have this? Do my symptoms add up to a thyroid condition? You know, and a lot of that, even adrenal glands work in conjunction with thyroid conditions. I mean, the two really don't, they go hand in glove. So you can get tests done for that and say, look, I really do have it. Now I want to attack it my way naturally. You don't have to jump on the bandwagon. So you can go to medically, you can get that checked, get a test done. You can also, you know, get it done through a naturopathic doctor and they'll have a look at that as well. So again, there's nothing wrong with checking that. I like to know what I have. I don't like to guess, mm-hmm. but you know, when I look at what do I want to do, then I like to take over and say, I'm going to do the heavy lifting here and I'll determine how this is going to work out. And, I'll do the best that I can giving the body what it needs rather than suppressing symptoms with something that I might have to go on for the rest of my life.
Oh, always appreciate your insights, Jorg. We've been talking with the nutritionist Jorg Mardian about the thyroid, and he's working on an article about this subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thanks again. We really do appreciate that. I'm sure this is information that really could be of benefit to quite a few people.
Oh, you're very welcome.
It's time for today's last word.
We had just had a lovely meal as a family at a local restaurant. Everyone was happy. It wasn't until we went out to the parking lot to get into the minivan that the horror began. I opened the side door with my remote from some distance away. I never get tired of using that feature. And my daughters, then ages 6 and 4, ran to get into the van. My mouth dropped then as the two of them tried to enter the same door at the same time. Thus erupted a spontaneous display of everything that is wrong with this world. The two girls stubbornly pushed forward, each wedging her body between immovable upholstery and mulish sibling, awkwardly bracing, positioning for leverage, struggling to emerge the dubious victor in this desperate battle to be first into the vehicle. I watched in stunned silence to see how long this bizarre warfare would go on. After what seemed like 45 minutes, it was probably closer to 10 seconds, I decided I didn't have the patience to find out. Girls! What in the world? Why do siblings do this to each other? I think back on my youth, and though I would never admit it at the time, I can think of instances where my own actions could only be described as being strategically calculated to drive my sister clinically insane. In some ways, it's ironic we refer so often to brotherly love. If you look in the Bible, you'll be hard-pressed to find a single great example of blood brothers or sisters who loved one another growing up, though many reconcile as adults. On the other hand, instances of sibling rivalry, sometimes murderous, abound. How to solve the problem? Ugly habits of competition and strife can take root in a single afternoon. Constructive habits of sharing, kindness, and self-sacrifice must be regularly reinforced over a period of years. So while there is no cure-all, consistent and focused attention to the matter can significantly improve it, at least for today. What are the root causes of this familial friction? Besides normal jealousy, one child simply wanting what the other child has and just up and taking it, often the problem originates with us. That's right. One of the biggest causes of sibling strife is simple neglect, a lack of time, attention, love, and approval from dad and mom. The good thing about it is that it can be remedied. We need to make sure each child feels tanked up emotionally so they're not competing for our attention. Spend quality, positive, individual time with every child, and you'll probably notice an improvement in their dealings with each other. Beware favoritism. Sibling rivalry is assured if you give a coat of many colors to one child and not the others. Children are acutely aware of any hint of unfairness. Since it's impossible to be fair all the time, strive to be equally unfair to all of your children. I'm just joking about that. But also, know each child as an individual. This prevents you from slipping into making comparisons between children that are certain to create bad feelings. As any parent of more than one child knows, they're all unique and different from day one. Be attentive. Praise each child for her personal strengths and work with each child to help her overcome her personal weaknesses. Spend alone time with each. Learn to treat each child as an only child. Still, even if we do these things perfectly, problems are bound to arise. It's critical to have firm rules against fighting with clear penalties for their infraction and consistent enforcement. Be alert to problems in their earliest stages and confront them. Don't wait for shouting and flying fists. Notice how the children talk to one another. Listen for bossy, selfish, hurtful, vindictive. Listen for subtle. As children grow, they should be expected to solve more of their problems on their own, but realize that it is a parental responsibility to teach them the way of peace. We need to ask God for discernment in handling problems as they arise, and whenever possible, avoid punishing a child who has done nothing wrong. But when I've had to deal with fighting children, I've found an almost miraculous effect in disciplining both children. After all, it does take two to fight, and then having them apologize to each other and hug. Whatever animosity existed between them tends to dissolve into squeezes, smiles, and giggles. One final word. Ideally, children should see an example of harmony and cooperation between their parents. As much as possible, a husband and wife should strive to be united on the rules of the house, on rewards and privileges, on when and how to discipline. If you argue in front of the children, you're teaching them by example how to fight. Instead, handle any disagreements between you privately. By our examples and our instruction, we can help our children experience the ways of family cooperation. The more we do, the more we'll see them take an after-you approach toward entering the minivan and to more of life's relationship challenges that will meet them down the road. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Brad McDonald, Andrew Miller, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Fred Astaire. The hardest job kids face today is learning good manners without seeing any. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.